And now, America's number one show on pop culture and politics. This is the Michael Medved Show.
Nation on God's green earth, and a great day to welcome to the show Molly Ball, who is the Wall Street Journal senior political correspondent. She covers campaigns, the White House, Congress, political personalities, and policy debates all across America. She is also the author of the best-selling biography of the first woman Speaker of the House. That would be Pelosi. She has written a new column that is already attracting a lot of response. It is appeared this morning in the Wall Street Journal under the headline, Biden woos left, but center is the prize. Some Democrats push president to recalibrate messages to win independence. Molly Ball, you were at the courtroom yesterday, weren't you, with President Trump?
I was indeed in New York City.
And first of all, it is true, it seems to me, and you allude to this in your writing, that there are many people on the Biden side of things that think that ultimately they're going to win because of President Trump's handling of his legal cases and of potential verdicts of guilty. Do you have confidence after watching President Trump yesterday? Today they're off in the court in Manhattan. Do you have confidence that he will be convicted on at least some of the counts that he is facing in the hush money trial, and that this could ruin his campaign?
You know, I never make predictions, but I think this is a particularly unpredictable situation. It's obviously unprecedented to have any former president, much less one who's running for office yet again, to be faced with criminal charges. So who knows how this could play out? And as you know, the only thing that's happened in this court case so far has been the pretrial motions and the jury selection. We now have seven of the jurors, so even that is not finished, and it's been a quite contentious process. It was very interesting to be in the courtroom and hear the back and forth and the questioning with these potential jurors who, you know, one of Trump's lawyers said at one point, look, usually when you get called for jury duty, you're not going to have any idea who the defendant is. But in this case, everybody knows this guy. Everybody's got an opinion about him. And that obviously poses a different challenge. So there's a lot of uncertainty about this case and the particulars of the case and what it means and how it could play out politically. And I really don't think we know. I think, you know, I remember a little over a year ago when this first indictment came down and it seemed like, oh boy, this is going to be really bad for Donald Trump. And he went on to absolutely run away with the primary and the nomination. So he's going to try to do the same thing in the general election. I think it plays differently with a general election electorate, but we shall see.
We shall see. Did you fall asleep at any point during the proceedings yesterday?
You know, I probably did. It's pretty boring. I really don't understand why some people see that as some kind of scandal. It's hard to sit still for, you know, 12 hours at a time without eventually getting a little bit bored, even if your potential liberty is at stake. Yeah, you know, a lot has been made of Trump nodding off a couple of times, but I really can't blame him. I was going on about 3 hours of sleep, and I think I probably did, too.
Okay, well, this, again, part of the reaction to Trump nodding off, as you so graciously put it, is that for years he was attacking Biden as Sleepy Joe. And again, and now the shoe is, as they say, on the other foot. In terms of Sleepy Joe, he seems to have awakened some of his base of support. There is a series of new polls, all of which show Biden gaining a point here, a point there, even in those swing states that he had been losing, and Trump falling a little bit behind. That's not a product, you say, of him wooing the left, which is a mistake, and I think most people would look at it and agree with you. But what do you think has caused the slight Biden bump, which has reoriented this race into a tie?
Well, yeah, you know, as you say, it is pretty much tied right now. I would be reluctant to call it, you know, it's not as if he has zoomed into a decisive sort of front-running position. But he does seem to have consolidated his base, I think, as you might expect at this phase of a general election. But I think there is some worry about his ability to move further ahead of Trump, given that, you know, what I was writing about, and thank you for mentioning my article, is that, you know, you see some of the actions that the president is taking on issues like the economy, on immigration, on student loans, even on the war in Israel. And he does seem to be catering to his left flank. And there's a potential for that to be alienating voters in the middle. And those are really where his problem lies. In our polling, in other polls, Biden and Trump are drawing about the same proportion of their respective party bases. But Trump is especially, you know, in the polls where Trump has been ahead, the reason for that is that Trump is leading with independents. And so there's a worry on the part of a lot of centrists that I spoke to that Biden isn't doing enough to cater to those people, especially given, you know, the opening that Trump theoretically provides him, given that Trump is a rather polarizing figure himself.
Well, you allude in your article to the fact that the protest votes against Joe Biden from the extreme left have not been overwhelming, and that the votes for Nikki Haley, even after she dropped her candidacy in primaries against Donald Trump, have represented a much bigger dissenting point of view in the Republican Party than in the Democratic Party.
That's right. I think there's been one of the misperceptions I sort of wanted to address with this analysis was, I think there's been a temptation for people to see, you know, these big protests everywhere the president goes, everywhere the vice president goes, these far left progressives who are pro-Palestinian and who don't like the president's continuing, if sometimes qualified, support for Israel. There's a temptation to look at those protesters and say, well, this must be the reason that Joe Biden is losing the election. He's losing these far left progressives. But again, when you look at the data, that really is not the case. Even in Michigan, the state where this is probably the biggest concern due to the large proportion of Arab American and Muslim voters, and given that there was a very well-funded and well-organized campaign to get people to mark their ballots uncommitted in the Democratic primary, even there, Biden's the support that Biden lost in that Democratic primary, 13%. It's about the same as President Obama lost in 2012 when there was no such organized campaign. So it's pretty insignificant when it comes to actual votes. On the other hand, as you mentioned, even with the nomination long over and these primaries just sort of going through the motions, we still see people coming to the polls to vote for Nikki Haley against Donald Trump, 10 or 20%, even in closed Republican primaries, of voters coming to the polls to cast protest votes in Republican primaries, and that is a potential opportunity for Biden. Those tend to be, you know, voters who are more moderate, maybe conservative leaning independents. A lot of them are not necessarily Republicans in open primaries, but they are, you know, sort of centrist voters. And the question is whether either campaign is going to be able to speak to those disaffected moderates. Trump has sort of actively refused to do anything to court Haley's voters. Biden's campaign has reached out to them, but he hasn't necessarily offered them anything when it comes to policy.
Okay, Molly Ball is our guest. Molly, can you stay with us for a few more minutes?
Sure, happy to.
Okay, we will look forward to coming back and talking about those voters in the middle. What is the key to unlocking that electoral prize? We'll be right back. Charlie Ball of the Wall Street Journal has written an important piece that says that while Biden worries about the left, the voters he really needs are those in the center. The president, some centrists argue, isn't doing enough to appeal to the moderate and independent voters who decide every election. And they really do. I mean, because the two parties are so closely divided, and both President Trump, according to the polls, and President Biden, according to the polls, are winning the overwhelming majority of their own party's voters. So the people they need are in the center. What could Biden do better, Molly Ball, to try to repeat his victory? Because his victory the last time was based on bringing America together and diminishing the polarization.
Yeah, well, there's a few, I think, policy areas where the centrists believe that he could be doing more to reach those moderate voters. One of them is certainly immigration. In our polling and others, voters overwhelmingly want to see the president get tough on the border, and they blame him. They blame his policies for the situation that's unfolded at the southern border. The president did belatedly come to the table in the bipartisan immigration talks in the Senate that produced a compromise bill, and then it didn't go anywhere after Trump came out against it. But since then, he has resorted to a strategy of simply blaming Republicans for not getting that done. He's talked about potentially doing some sort of executive action, and there's polling that suggests that it would be popular if he were to do that. But he hasn't done so, and it appears to be, from our reporting, out of a combination of legal concerns and worries about blowback from the progressive base. So I think, you know, you could look at the economy, at energy policy, at other areas where there's a potential for him to make some gesture to the center that he hasn't done. But immigration, I think, is really a big one, given how top of mind that issue is for voters.
Well, then, aren't they supposed to, as part of this new separation of the $95 billion supplemental foreign aid bill that they're going to have a vote on Saturday night, apparently, in the House to get that through? That would be a little bit of a help for Biden actually being able to deliver on the support for allies, which is important to him and to his political persona. What about President Trump and his appeal to the center? Because when he was running ahead in polls just a couple of weeks ago, and he was running ahead in six out of the seven swing states, a lot of that indicated that he was winning the center of the electorate. What's the centrist pitch that Trump has used somewhat successfully?
Well, you know, what we see in a lot of these polls is that voters look back pretty fondly, a lot of voters do, on the Trump presidency, not necessarily the more, you know, chaotic and divisive aspects of it, but particularly the economy. There's a feeling that the economy was strong when Trump was president, and people don't necessarily feel that way today. You know, I think the point that you made about the supplemental is a really good one. People don't necessarily see Biden as able to get things done and as sort of being in control. And Trump, for all that, you know, his critics would call him an aspiring authoritarian, he does have that strongman image. And I think voters like to see a president that they feel is strong. So I think, you know, Biden being able to get something done on the foreign aid package would be an important win in that column. And he's just going to have to demonstrate to people that he's in command, that he's able to get things done, and that he is, you know, delivering on these pocketbook issues that really matter to voters. I think voters are not that interested in the sort of chaos and the stuff like the Trump trial that drives so many cable news segments. It doesn't necessarily affect them where they live, and they feel like when it comes to that kind of thing, they may have been better off with Trump as president.
In reality, President Trump has called for the biggest mass deportations in American history concerning the immigration issue. He's talking about deporting 14 million people. And do you believe that that is has appeal to the center of the electorate?
I would be surprised if people liked it in practice were he to actually carry that out. But what we do see is that people are so annoyed about the border situation that they would like to see practically anything done. You know, in our polling on the border issue, we saw that there was majority support for comprehensive immigration reform, including a pathway to citizenship. There's also majority support for mass deportations. I think there's a feeling that voters just want to see someone do something, and they don't like the idea that the situation is just out of control.
In terms of the good news about crime, and there have been several articles recently about the decline in the homicide rate, which is nationwide about 20%. It's supposed to be the sharpest decline in homicide figures since the mid-90s. So that's something I am surprised, frankly, we haven't heard more about from President Biden.
I am, too. And I think you're right that this is an issue where he does have the potential to claim a win. You know, he got so much flack for the crime and disorder. It was such a huge issue in the midterms. I don't know if people remember, but in 2022, the number one issue in those political ads was not the economy or anything else. It was crime. And there was a feeling that particularly these, you know, ghostly downtowns that COVID had emptied out were just out of control and dangerous. Crime has come way down, and the president could be taking a victory lap for that. I don't know if there's a worry that, you know, the far left that wants to defund the police and dismantle the, you know, mass incarceration state, if they wouldn't like to hear him claim a victory on that, or if he just hasn't gotten around to it. But I'll be interested to see if he starts actually talking about that and trying to take credit for it.
Okay, last question, and I've actually do two questions quickly, and it has to do with anticipating the future. One is, what kind of support will Robert Kennedy get, and who will Trump select as a running mate?
I don't make predictions, so I'm not going to answer any of that. But I do think that Kennedy is a real threat, and I think it would not be surprising to see him get quite a bit of traction just because voters are so upset about the two choices that they have. They don't like either of these candidates. Can't say it enough. This is not an election anyone's excited about, and I think a lot of people are going to be looking for a third option.
And no pick for a running mate. Well, Trump hasn't gotten to that yet, but if he picks a running mate that appeals to the center, that would be smart. Molly Ball writes about the center as the key to American politics. Her piece is posted at michaelmedved.com. Molly, have a happy spring season, and great to speak to you. We will be right back on the MedVed Show.
I don't know exactly who you are.
Your cultural crusader.
At where this is going.
All across America. This is the Michael MedVed Show.
By constitutional scholar John Yu, who is a non-resident senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, a visiting fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford, and he covers not only Stanford but University of California at Berkeley, which is his full-time job, where he is the Emanuel S. Heller Chair in Law, and that he holds. And he is a distinguished professor of law at Cal Berkeley. He's also the author of numerous books, including the recent bestseller, The Politically Incorrect Guide to the Supreme Court. John Yu, I don't know if you had heard the news just breaking, the impeachment trial, such as it was, of Alejandro Mayorkas, the Secretary of Homeland Security, is over. The Senate voted along party lines that both of the articles of impeachment were unconstitutional because they did not rise to a high crime or misdemeanor. Any reaction to the end of the Mayorkas impeachment trial?
Well, it's great to be with you again, Michael. That's amazing. I hadn't heard that news. One thing we should keep in mind is the Constitution gives to the Senate the sole power to try impeachments. And so one question is, does the power to try impeachments include the power just to dismiss the case before you even had a trial because you think it's legally or constitutionally insufficient? Second point is, I'm not so sure that this impeachment is unconstitutional. I know that Secretary Mayorkas' defenders have been saying, well, he's only carrying out the president's orders with regard to the border. So if you want to impeach somebody, impeach Biden. I'm not so sure that's the correct answer, because that almost creates a system where you can only impeach the president. And the founders clearly thought you could impeach cabinet secretaries. So I'd want to see more when the Senate actually produces its reasons for getting rid of the case, to see whether it really does measure up to constitutional standards.
Well, again, it was along party lines. There was only one variation of that, where Lisa Murkowski, the senator from Alaska, on the first article of impeachment, she voted present. So that article was more decisive. She appears to have joined with her Republican colleagues in voting against the dismissal and killing of the case. But there's no way at this point that some of the constitutional scholars like Mike Lee and Ted Cruz on the other side of this issue, they can't somehow appeal to reaffirm the constitutionality that their Senate colleagues have voted does not adhere here.
That is true. So one important thing is there was a case called Nixon versus United States. And unlike almost every other case that has the word Nixon in it, this was not Richard Nixon. But it was a case about impeachment and a Judge Nixon. And the Supreme Court there said, since the Constitution says sole power to try impeachments is of the Senate, actually the courts have said, the Supreme Court has said, we will not second guess or ever review what happens in an impeachment trial. That's all up to the Senate. And so this decision today, that's the final word as far as the Supreme Court's concerned. One last point I should have mentioned, Michael, is if this view is correct, that the Senate could just refuse to hold a trial and just dismiss the case, then what would have happened during President Trump's impeachments when there were Republicans in the majority, I believe, in the Senate? They could have just said, we're not going to have a trial for President Trump because we don't think these charges have merit and we're just going to dismiss right away. That's the door that's now open for the future.
Which is a fascinating prospect, but let's hope. Would you agree that we have been in recent American history a little bit too trigger happy to go to the impeachment solution, which again, other than Andrew Johnson, it had been until it was resurrected with the Nixon case. We hadn't had any serious impeachment drive against a president.
That's an excellent point, Michael. I think the founders probably thought we would impeach people more often than we have. But almost immediately after the Constitution went into effect, I think our political leaders realized it was, as you say, a tool not to be used very often for most of the history of the country until President Clinton. Maybe President Nixon is not a serious tool other than the serious fight between the president and Congress during Reconstruction with Andrew Johnson. And one reason why is you don't want Congress to have a kind of no confidence ability to remove a president just because they don't like him or just because they're from a different political party. The founders wanted the standard for removing a president to be much, much higher than just political disagreements or partisan fighting or even disputes over policy.
Speaking of disputes over policy, there was a Supreme Court oral arguments yesterday about some of the charges against the rioters who participated in January 6th. And it looks like the court may decide that one of the causes that the rioters were prosecuted and convicted and in some cases jailed, that that may not meet constitutional muster. What's your guess as the direction there?
Just going by what I heard of oral argument yesterday, but more importantly, looking at what the Supreme Court's been doing in criminal law lately, I would guess that the court is going to say those charges can't be used against January 6th protesters and rioters, or I think against Donald Trump. The basic idea is that there's a statute that was passed after the 2000-2001 accounting scandals that it's called Sarbanes-Oxley, which said that it was a crime to try to, you know, mutilate, destroy documents that are needed for congressional proceeding. And then it says, the statute says, and other, you know, basically says, and any other types of obstruction. And so the question is that and any other basically mean all kinds of obstruction, or does it mean only the kind like destroying documents, mutilating evidence, and so on? I think that this court has been very reluctant to give the Justice Department a lot of freedom on those kinds of statutes. There was a famous case a few years ago about fish being thrown back into the ocean where the Justice Department tried to use a similar law to say a fisherman who'd caught the wrong kind of fish and threw it back in the water was trying to destroy evidence. And the Supreme Court said, you can't do that. That's too broad a reading of the statute. I bet that's what this court's going to do with this January 6th case, too. That doesn't mean the January 6th rioters are going to get off because, you know, there's some who attack police. There are people who trespass. There's all kinds of other charges. But this one about protecting evidence, documentary evidence, it doesn't seem well suited to what happened on January 6th.
So we will have all of these legal decisions coming up, and we have the jury selection, which is majority done, at least, in the hush money trial. What are those trials going to mean to the next presidential election and really to the future of the country? We'll get to that with Professor John Yu of University of California, coming right up on The Medved Show.
From politics to pop culture and from coast to coast, this is The Michael Medved Show.
And on the Michael Medved Show, the court in Manhattan that is hearing the ongoing hush money case against President Trump, it's not just hush money, it's hush money for porn stars, that case. Uplifting, isn't it? We are talking about that with Professor John Yu of the University of California, who is author of most recently of the best-selling book, The Politically Incorrect Guide to the Supreme Court. I know you've been following, like everybody else, not just in the legal world, but in America at large, you've been following the development of this case in New York. And what's interesting is you've made an extremely persuasive, it seems to me, point about the gag orders that have been issued to try to prevent President Trump from basically condemning the proceedings or the judge or the judge's daughter involving the case against him. What's the biggest argument against those gag orders?
There's really two, Michael. One is that he's running for president. That's really the purpose of the First Amendment, is to protect political speech so we can make decisions about who to elect, what policies to adopt. So President Trump, in a way, is his First Amendment rights should have, I think, even more force than any regular criminal trial, because he's in the middle of a presidential campaign and he's going to be the nominee of one of the two major parties. But put that to one side, even if you were just a regular criminal defendant, this order says he's not allowed to criticize or attack evidence, criticize and attack witnesses. That makes no sense to me, because in the courtroom itself, President Trump is going, his lawyers are going to attack the witnesses and they're going to attack the evidence. So it doesn't seem to me to make any sense as a First Amendment matter to gag President Trump from saying outside the courtroom what he's going to say inside the courtroom. In fact, if I were the prosecutors, I would love it, because it would tell me in advance what his lawyers were going to do.
Okay, well, there you have it on that issue. He's not going to end up in, I think he would be eligible for 4 days in prison if he's held guilty of contempt or something like that. But it's a much more serious potential term if he is found guilty as charged in the hush money case. He could go to prison conceivably for 4 years. That's the same as a presidential term. What is your guess about the outcome of this trial?
Several interesting things that you can already see developing just from the first few days of the trial this week. One is, despite there being serious, I think, constitutional legal issues with prosecuting a president for this in state court of federal crimes, the judge here is moving quickly. He's not slowing down to really consider these issues deeply, or to give time for higher courts to step in early and make a ruling on those issues. The other thing is the jury, you know, we're in the middle of jury selection, what's called voir dire, and you might have read half the jury pool just admitted right away up front that they could not be unbiased towards President Trump. That's an incredible number. I mean, that's even before you start having the jurors individually come up and the lawyers ask them questions, or the judge asks them questions about, for example, do they have any relatives who work for the police, or do they have any relatives who've been to jail? That shows you, I think, how liberal, compared to President Trump, if you call him a conservative, how liberal this jury pool is. And I think it underscores his argument that it's very, very hard for him to get a fair trial, to get a really impartial jury here.
And so your sense is that there is a serious chance of a guilty verdict, which would have, at least according to most of the polls, a serious impact on the presidential race. What do you think?
One thing about whether we're going to get a guilty verdict is the star witness here, and we've not seen anything about him yet, is Michael Cohen, who used to be President Trump's sort of personal fixer and then pled guilty to actually the conduct involved here, paying off a movie star and then allegedly concealing the payments. And then he turned on President Trump. So here's a person who's a convicted felon who's changed his story several times. This is the star witness for the prosecution. That's really when I would pay the closest attention to what's going to happen. And I think that's where guilt or innocence is going to turn, is whether the jury finds Michael Cohen to be credible. If he's not a credible witness, it's hard to see how you get a conviction here.
There's also a question about whether President Trump is going to testify in his own behalf. Apparently, his attorneys think that's a bad idea, but he feels compelled to do so. First of all, how do you think it should go? And secondly, how do you think it will go?
I think it's crazy for him to waive his Fifth Amendment right to refuse to testify and self-incriminate himself. This is a case that's really about documents. Why get up and subject yourself to, right? Not just testifying on your own behalf, but the prosecution gets to cross-examine him, and he's going to be under oath. And if he lies, it's perjury. Why subject yourself to that kind of vulnerability? On the other hand, as we discussed on the show before, Michael, what he's been doing is taking every setback in court, all these prosecutions and all these different places from Miami to D.C. to New York now, twice, and turning them to his political advantage. Maybe he thinks that this is going to illustrate his argument that he's being persecuted. Maybe if the prosecution goes too far, it's going to undermine the legitimacy of any verdict in the eyes of the American public. And that's more important to him for the election than what happens in the particular trial.
President Trump has said on many occasions that they're not really coming after me. They're coming after you. And they're only it's because Trump is standing in the way of a war against ordinary people that that he has been subjected to this kind of harsh treatment. What's the best argument he could make in that regard, that this is actually an assault on ordinary Americans, not just wealthy people who can afford hush money for porn stars?
Yeah, it's hard to see how this relates to the life of everyday people. I hope it has no relevance at all to 99.9% of Americans. But, maybe a better way to put it for him would be to say what the American people don't realize is prosecutors have a lot of discretion on who to pick to prosecute and throw the huge weight of the government against somebody. And we know what people don't realize is that power can be really abused. We tend to trust prosecutors. We trust the police. We need to have public integrity and public faith for the criminal justice system to work. And so his point would be, but if we allow prosecutors like this to get in charge, people like Alvin Bragg, who's refusing to throw people in jail for actual violent crimes in New York City instead of spending millions of dollars on Trump, well, that just shows you the potential abuse in the system. And that does affect the daily lives of everyone who lives in Manhattan, for example.
We were talking during the break, and you made a very informed and profound point, which was that part of what all of this shows is that de Tocqueville was right. Alexander de Tocqueville, who toured the United States, wrote Democracy in America back in the 1830s. What was he right about?
It's really interesting. I mean, sometimes we have to turn to some, French nobleman who was just touring the country for a few years for some of the deepest insights about American society. And one thing very interesting, he said, most important political questions eventually in the United States, because we are so, we're so wrapped in with the rule of law and lawyers and our very strong legal system. He said most important political questions in America eventually become legal questions and eventually get settled in court. Unfortunately, I think he's right here, even though we're almost 100 years later, because here we have a question. The political question is Donald Trump fit to be president? Is he someone that we should send back to the White House? But it's become a legal question, too. It's become a matter for the criminal courts to have a role, because, as you said, if he gets convicted of a felony, there's many Americans who at least tell the pollsters that they won't vote for him.
So we can end with agreement with de Tocqueville that in America, too many things end up in the legal system, in the court system, decided by the judiciary rather than the legislature or the executive. John Yoo, so greatly appreciate your contributions to this greatest nation on God's green earth.